This piece was brought to you by Heritage Foods USA. HeritageFoodsUSA.com. HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
This is the news.
Heritage Radio Network turns the tables for a provocative conversation about media, authenticity, and food feuds at Bonnaroo. In an interactive session with the Heritage Radio Network team and special guests Talia Ralph and Jess Capadia, we invite a panel of audience members to weigh in on some of the most provocative issues in food. From serious opinions on festival eats to conversation on whose barbecue is best, we turn the tables on food radio to share perspectives about what's happening at Bonnaroo and beyond. This panel was recorded at Bonnaroo Arts and Music Festival 2015 and moderated by Allison Hamlin.
Today we'll probably turn to you guys for some inspiration on the radio. We are recording this panel live, and we're going to broadcast it over our channels, all on the internet. So if you guys, we'd love to get some feedback from you. We're going to do a little audience call and response a little bit later. So definitely stay tuned. We'll throw some questions your way. But for now, I'd like to introduce our panel who will be keeping us abreast of all things in the food media scene. And I'd like to, on the far end, introduce Talia Ralph. She holds an MA in food studies from New York University. And she's also a freelance journalist for Vice, Lucky Peach, Edible Brooklyn, and the Boston Globe, among others. So Talia has a bit of a background in food media, one might say. And to my immediate right is Jess Capadia. Did I say that right?
Yes.
All right. That's a big success for today already. I'll put that in the checkmark column. Jess is the senior editor at foodrepublic.com, and she's joining us from a session of work/play here at Bonnaroo, doing some reporting on the food scene here. So Jess has kind of been on the ground taking photos and talking to vendors here, so she's got a really good lay of the land, and we're hoping to tap her a little bit. I am Allison Hamlin. I am the deputy director of Heritage Radio Network, and my background is varied and weird, but you know, I come at this through kind of an academic lens, and what I do is look at food culture issues, both in trying to make the world a little more sustainable, equitable, and delicious, one conversation at a time. So at Heritage Radio, we really pride ourselves at going deep on the issues, and hopefully this is an opportunity for us to get some of your feedback in that conversation. So without too much more ado, I want to jump into our first segment. So we want to talk a little bit about the state of food media. We think if we're going to be turning a lens of criticism on the food world, what better place to start than our own backyard? So we'll talk about us, and we'll give you a chance to weigh in on how well we're doing at our jobs. So first, I kind of want to talk about why food media is important to you ladies. And Jess, maybe I'll have you take us off on this question.
Why is food media important? Well, have you looked at Instagram lately? Is where I'd like to start with that. Why it's important to me personally is actually along those lines. I remember just from my earliest memories, my mother's a chef, and she would always have Cooks Illustrated and Gourmet and Bon Appetit, and no matter what other reading material was available to me, I found myself gravitating towards these publications because of their beautiful art and because of their approach to cooking, which I always found to be a very interesting thing. So the state of food media is as progressive as it's ever been. 15 years ago, if you turned on the Food Network, you would see a handful of shows, not very varied. You had your Emeril, you had your Bobby Flay, Jan Can Cook, you know, Southern, Asian. But there wasn't this incredible, we had to make the cooking channel because the Food Network wasn't big enough. These are really interesting things, and it's happening so fast that we need all these outlets for all this interest. It seems to me like we're in a pretty good place.
All right, Talia, what's your take?
Well, I got into food media sort of through the back door of journalism, but I was doing breaking international news, and I got into journalism in the first place. It sounds corny, but because I wanted to change the world, I wanted to help educate people, and I really wanted to be an international correspondent, but I found that the pace and the sort of quick hit style of breaking news really wasn't letting me do that, and so I wanted to be writing about something that I thought really affected people. And when I thought about what affects me the most and what brings me the most joy, or conversely can ruin my day, it's food. And I found that being in the food world and studying food and talking to people throughout the space, that it just has, it's like music. It has this spark and this power to just really excite and connect people. And as a journalist, that's where you want to be, where the action is happening. So for me, the action is happening in the food movement right now. And I wanted to get in on it before the wave crashes.
It's a little like a real estate bubble here.
I really hope the wave doesn't crash. I'm having so much fun.
Well, so that's an interesting take. My arrival to food media came through event planning. And the thing I loved about food events, and specifically what I was doing, was wine and spirits and cocktail education for people who are non-professionals. And I loved the feeling of leaving a room with people who had just learned something that they were going to use again and again, that it was like, you know, it became part of them and they wanted to tell their friends. And I love transforming people's lives in that way. But I think, you know, not everybody has the ability to have access to those kinds of experiences. And so it's really incumbent upon us as the food media to be responsible and to be able to make space in those areas so that we can have those conversations, so we can bring more people to the table. You know, and I think especially with the dawn and the advent of free media in many ways, which is kind of also a can of worms in its own way, but I think that we are succeeding finally at getting more voices in this conversation. And ultimately, I think the diversity of different perspectives is such a great thing to change the course of just the way that we think about food in general. So let's define food media. I guess we want to, how many of you guys have Instagrammed a picture of your food so far here at Bonnaroo? You get a show of hands, maybe? So you guys? Just you guys? Because I can't believe that, but all right. So ladies, what's your take? What is food media? What isn't food media? Where do you draw that line?
I'll go first. I think food media is incredibly broad. It's any piece of information that we're exchanging that tells you something about what you're eating. So a cookbook is food media. An Instagram photo is food media. A long-form journalism piece is food media. Every show on the Food Network is. I think it's anything that is communicating some kind of message about what's on our plates and how it's getting there and how we're interacting with it. So it's broader than you'd think.
Okay, that seems like a pretty wide stance, Jets. Do you agree
with
this?
I have an equally wide stance. That's almost exactly what I was going to say. Except it's just that the term food media hasn't been around for as long as we think it has. Like when I was a little kid watching those old shows that I liked so much, I don't think we used the term food media because there wasn't really an organized blanket term for all the ways that we convey food. So I like that the term exists at all. And I absolutely agree. It's anything that you can consume besides the food itself. Any other way that you can consume the idea of food counts as food media.
I always think of the food movement as a little bit analogous to the environmentalism movement, that 20 years ago no one knew what it was like to be an environmental studies major, to build a life and a career around a set of values and a kind of a compass towards certain issues. And I think ultimately what food media has done for many is to send them down paths where they would not have originally found to become professionals in those spaces and to develop a really well-skilled cadre of people who are making those changes and are pushing that conversation in so many different spaces, whether that's in a kitchen, whether that is in a nonprofit organization, you know, like the ones we have here today. You know, Oxfam and Eat for Equity are two really amazing groups that are doing that work. You know, or whether that is a publication that is talking to, you know, people or sharing restaurant reviews. I think across the board, it's good stuff. Okay, so here's our report card time, and I'm gonna send this out to you guys in the audience as soon as we're done. But I'm curious if you had to give food media today a grade based on quality, how well would you say we're doing?
Jess, you want to go first?
Okay. I would like to give more credit for effort. Like, you know, when you get partial credit for getting most of it right? It's very difficult to be properly informed on the state of food if you want to be a blogger or a writer or a TV show producer. It's so difficult to do all of your research and get all your ducks in line so that you can push out the right information. So that all said, I would give the state of things about a B. But there is, I'm so looking forward to that improvement that there's room for, because the more we all learn about food, everybody wins. There's no such thing as knowing too much about food. Being a food nerd is a great thing. Knowing where your eggs come from is a special thing. And the more we celebrate these wonderful aspects of the food world, the higher that grade will go. I don't think it's going to go any lower. We have definitely hit the threshold. We are Instagramming big gooey burgers when we're not writers, bloggers, photographers. That's beautiful. I can't wait to see more of that. And I do want to see more blogs, and I want to see more, you know, investment bankers and lawyers abandoning their firms and becoming chefs, which happens all the time, all over the country, all over the world even. People from all walks of life are just leaving what they did to open a food truck or one of the other very challenging parts of being in this sphere. So yeah, a firm, solid B with exciting room for improvement.
All right. Well, points for improvement. Talia, what's your grade?
I'm going to be a little harsher. I'm going to say C+, because I find that food media is still very siloed, and I think it's still very very culture-focused, which I think is important. I think people love, myself included. I'm a huge restaurant news junkie. I always want to know what's opening and closing, and I love hearing about chefs, and I go to recipe websites all the time. I worked for one, Food 52, for a while, and they're amazing. But I really think where we have a responsibility as media is to tell people about the stuff that's like not fun and glitzy and glamorous, and I think we're failing. I think a lot of food-focused outlets are sort of shirking their responsibility to cover that in a way that feels true to them and works for their audience, but it's an audience that cares about food, and that means you know, you need to care about how it's being grown, you need to care about who's having access to it and who isn't. And so I've been a little frustrated as a freelancer with food-focused outlets sort of neglecting that less fun but very real responsibility. I think we do see that coverage. Michael Pollan is paving the way in the New York Times. He's telling people about stuff they never knew about before, but, you know, we can't have one or two mouthpieces. So C+, you're passing, but we could do better.
All right, I'm going to split the difference here. I know that's a coward move, but B- is my grade. And I think I agree with both of you in the sense that I think the spaces that food media perhaps is failing us is a lack of perspective. Last winter, we did a radio course with some high school students in a food desert in New York City, and the stories that they came back with echoed so many of the themes that we had heard, you know, time and time again throughout our research, but having them told by people who are living through that reality, by teenagers living in a food desert in the Far Rockaways, devastated by Superstorm Sandy, was so eye-opening. And I think it's disarming to hear those voices because so often they're shut out. So I think that what food media can do better in the future is to make itself more available, to become uncomfortable, and to seek out those voices in a way that feels authentic and feels real and capable of telling a story that doesn't just make us feel good, but really does something to enlighten people about the world that they live in and how people besides themselves are interacting with the food. So I want to turn the mic out. Sam has a mic. And what I'd love to do is, you guys have a thought on the state of food media. If you want to raise your hand, give us a grade, let us know how we're doing, and tell us a little more about why you think that. So we got any takers?
We have some cool presents for those of you that do.
All right.
One?
Okay. All right. Well,
you guys are all giving us an A+. Great. Okay. We can leave now.
All right.
Go back to work.
I know you guys are shy. Oh, do we got somebody? One. No. Okay. Well, I know you're shy.
We do.
Hello.
Hi there.
Well, this is actually a little interesting for me because my best friend writes for HungryGirl.com, and they're based out in California. And I know that she and I, whenever we talk a lot about food and the difference between how you feel when you eat organic and when you don't. Mm-hmm. And also just the difference of how food makes you feel. And so what I'd like to do is see more of that in the news and in the media, and to see more of a conversation about how food can actually improve your energy and your life and your overall internal well-being. So in that regard, I think I might give it a little bit of a lower grade just because I haven't seen as much of that out there yet.
Yeah, be harsh on us. So what do you give us?
A C.
That's fair. I think that's fair. You think we're average. We can do better.
I'm not saying you guys specifically. I'm saying everyone in general.
We're not offended. Don't worry.
Not at all.
Because it wasn't meant as an insult.
Definitely.
That's a great point.
I think you're entirely right. And that's perhaps a space that we can do more to speak about our own experiences with food and open up that platform in a way that feels authentic to you. So whether that is over your own social media, whether that is in a conversation, whether that is looking for some more kind of like health and mindfulness based coverage, you know, and I would say I would open the door to you to ask for that and to go to your news sources and request it, because honestly, we're very open to some suggestions, if you can't tell. And it's always nice. It's always nice to be making things that people want. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. So we're going to move on. We're going to talk a little bit more to you guys about authenticity. It's kind of a buzzword in the food community, and it's a space that I think raised some hackles in conversations because people have a lot of feelings about what is authentic and what is not. So what makes good food good, guys?
I mean, it tastes great. It looks beautiful. I think the visuals are really important, and we see that with a lot of food photography and Instagram. What it looks like is really important. And I think a great story. You know, I want to know who's making it, why they're making it, whose recipe is it. And I think maybe because I'm a storyteller, so I'm a little bit biased, but I think food with a great story, like, you know, the lawyer who left to start a food truck, or actually some of the food trucks over here, we had them on a panel the other day, and they have some incredible, you know, going out on a limb, losing jobs, being in really tough situations, being just out of college. And I think those stories really shape the experience of being excited and wanting to taste where these people are coming from through what they're making.
Did hearing those stories make you want to eat their food more?
Yes. Yeah, I went to the roti rolls truck like immediately after the panel, and it lived up to all my expectations. I'm going again after this.
Die hard. Okay, Jess, what makes good food good?
What makes good food good, in my opinion, actually throws back to that very thoughtful comment that you asked. Thank you again so much for that. It really is about how you feel. It's an experience. When you look at it, the fact that we are now compelled to immediately take out our phones and like toss a Hudson filter over it, that makes you feel good. It makes you feel good that you're showing everybody that you're eating well. It makes you feel good that you're eating something that you're so into that you want to show them in general. And hopefully, increasingly, the food that we're eating will actually physically, scientifically and chemically make us feel better than something that is not so good to put in your body. So what makes good food good for me is the ultimate satisfaction of after I have looked at it, Instagrammed it maybe, and then consumed it and thought about it. If I feel really good, that is good food.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about whether or not authenticity is a prerequisite for deliciousness. So, give you an example here. Is it important to make the most authentic representation of a food before we can consider its deliciousness? Like, is that a higher order priority for us as eaters to think about where the food has come from, how it's being made, and whether or not it's true to the spirit of what this food should be. Should we value that over how totally delicious it might taste in our mouth?
I defer to Andy Ricker on this one. And I think intention is everything, because when you get into authenticity, you're in a really like dark and murky swamp where you don't know which way is up, because depending on what, you know, you grew up with, a dish could be totally different. You know, I grew up Jewish. I have a lot of Jewish friends, and our grandmothers all make a different kind of matzo ball soup. Some people put dill, some people don't. Some people do carrots and onions.
Mine puts dill.
So to say that one is more authentic than the other, you're essentially invalidating another person's experience that was entirely authentic because it was made by their Jewish grandma. So I think as long as the intention is there, and that goes back to, you know, how what I was saying about storytelling, I think knowing, you know, a chef like Andy Ricker, who runs Pock Pock in New York and Portland and a few other locations. He's white, but he cooks Thai food so authentically because he's traveled extensively. He employs Thai chefs. He's, you know, really almost, you know, military grade about how everything is made in his kitchen. And if you were to call his food inauthentic, I think you would not only be insulting him, but you'd be wrong. So I think that a lot of it comes from the way it's being made and who's making it and why they're making it.
Yeah, I could not agree more. And that's a really good example. If you've ever opened the Pock Pock cookbook, I'm a pretty good cook and I can't make half the stuff in there.
It's
I don't
really
know where
scary.
To find the various things, and it's all metric so that it's very exact. I admire the way he cooks so much, and yeah, that's that's a really great example. An example I think of immediately is Chef Marcus Samuelson, who is one of the co-founders of Food Republic, and who was born in Ethiopia, raised in Sweden, and then came over to the States to be a chef, a Swedish chef, not Swedish chef, but a Swedish chef. And now he runs Red Rooster Harlem and Ginny's, which are very successful restaurants in Harlem. There's a charity component, and it's all just a wonderful organization. But on his menu of sort of an upscale soul food, permanently on the menu, and this is always going to be the case, his grandma's Swedish meatballs. And that's one of the most popular items on the menu. And there's a little bit of Ethiopian influence, too. So if a chef has that much drive and passion and has had such an interesting, storied career like Marcus or like Andy, the end product that you come up with is definitely going to be their authentic, which as a chef is very authentic. So I would say knowing where food comes from, you know, and Marcus never lived in Ethiopia, but he made it his business to make many, many trips back and understand the food of his people so that his modern applications on Top Chef, as I'm sure you've seen, or if you've had the fortune of visiting Red Rooster Harlem, which has incredible food, those influences come through as not only well-intentioned, but done just exactly right.
I think often, actually, of Sean Brock, who has a cookbook that came out recently, and it's called Heritage. If you guys haven't seen it, it's a tome to Southern cooking, and Sean has spent the last several years essentially creating relationships with local producers. So whether that's Pappy Van Winkle's distillery, whether that is, I'm trying to remember the name of the rice farmer.
Anson Mills.
Yeah. And he really meticulously details all of these different places that he goes to source his ingredients and really says in precise language that this dish will only be as good as it can be if you use the authentic ingredients that he, you know, he has done some intense research to provide you. And I think that there is some tension there because I'm not sure everybody is really able to go and get the access to those items. And I think sometimes it is upsetting for home cooks who are using that book to be a little bit put off by their inability to access kind of the highest echelon of this cuisine. But at the same time, I do think it is remarkable how true to form he stayed and how clearly that vision has played out. So authenticity seems like a double-edged sword in many ways, because you will always, in saying one thing is right, implicate that another way is wrong.
I do just want to say, though, that we all were three women on the stage, and we just brought up three male chefs. Yeah. And so I think that that's an interesting thing to consider when you think about authenticity of cooking, because traditionally, in almost every culture, cooking is done by women. And yet in the professional space, we have cooking done largely by men, and the professional space made really hostile to women, actually. And so I think that is a little bit of a tough twist when you're talking about authenticity, because you're talking about women feeding people most of the time at home, and yet professionally, obviously there are great female chefs across the country, but much tougher and much rarer. And that's really unfortunate and inauthentic if you think about the history of cooking. So
yeah, so shout out,
throw that out there.
Shout out to Diana Kennedy here.
Yes, and Anna Sortoon, and a lot of other people.
Okay, so back to you guys. I know this is the part you dread, but I would encourage you to speak up if you have a thought. So we're curious, have you guys eaten anything recently, either here or nearby, or recently, just anyway, that is a food that you are familiar with, maybe from your home, maybe a place that you feel really attached to, that you either found super authentic or was an interpretation that you thought was inauthentic? And I would love to hear some thoughts about why you made that choice and why you decided it was or wasn't. So throw your hand up. Do you guys eat anything here? Come on, you're so quiet. Okay, we got one right over here. Okay, tell us about your authentic or inauthentic food experience.
So I kind of just have a question to your question. Can you kind of tie authenticity back to the whole, like why that's important, like why you're really considering that? Also, how much, this is on the last subject, but how much does food media actually have an influence on others? I mean, the people who are Instagramming their gooey burgers with cheese and you know, all of this fun stuff on it, they are kind of, you know, what's their limit? What's their range of people that they're actually influencing? And are the people that are seeing this, these posts, are they actually caring about, oh, I want to make you know, healthier choices, or like, oh, you know, this burger actually influenced me to get another burger? So I'm just kind of curious, these things kind of they just seem kind of small in the realm of the big idea. So I'm just kind of curious how all of the parts constitute the whole.
That is a great question. I want to throw this maybe to you, Talia, because I think that... No?
No. Yeah.
All right, okay.
I'll take it.
Because I think ultimately that is a difficult question to answer, but I think it also depends very much on who you are and what your picture looks like and who you're sharing it with and what your network looks like. And I would apply the same standard to any media outlet who is saying that they're going to do the same thing. Because ultimately, it's about what your network looks like and how close they are to you, and how much they trust your opinion. You know, are they a bunch of close ties? Are they people that follow you because they know you personally? Are they a following of people because you have been retweeted or promoted? Who is really driving that conversation? And I think it really just depends on how much you push your pedal on the gas, or the strength of that network that you have.
To tackle your first question, why is authenticity important, or what does it tie into? I think, going back to our first comment, authentic food is generally better for you. You know what I mean? If you're cooking the way that people used to cook or want to cook or recommend cooking, it's not just a cultural thing. Often it's a nutritional thing. I took a great nutrition class where I learned, you know, really basic stuff that I never knew, like rice and beans, when you eat them together, make a complete protein. And there's so many Latin American cultures that do that. And it's not just because they're like, rice and beans are good together. It actually does something chemically in your body to make you healthier. And so I think authenticity often we get caught up in, you know, sort of a petty, like, how legit is this food? I don't think it's about that. I think it's ingredients. I think it's culture. I think it's health. If you're looking at someone like Sean Brock, it's supporting, you know, local farmers and local varieties of things in a country where we have just bulldozed our agriculture to be, you know, basically monoculture. I think authenticity promotes a lot of things that are really healthy for us and for the earth. So that's why we get picky about it. And to answer your second question about, you know, what's the media's influence, it's huge. And that's why I gave us such a bad grade, is because I think we get really caught up in the photogenic, you know, 2,000 calories, so disgusting, it's delicious. And I participate in that. And it's really fun and it's special, but it should be fun and special and rare and available to everyone. And right now we have a situation in North America and really most of the world where that's not the case. And so I think the media is the arbiter of authenticity, and we need to be doing a better job, you know, pushing why it's important to care about this stuff, because we have a lot of epidemics related to food in this country that are very serious and really can be traced back to how authentically are we eating. And the answer is not very. Burgers and fries are not, you know, yes, they're American and they're a huge part of our culture, but they're not the way that we want to be eating every day. So,
yeah. And I'll definitely take it from there. While you were talking, I was thinking about this one scene. I'm sure most of you saw the movie Food, Inc. By Robert Kenner, which was a contender for an Oscar. I think it should have won, but you can't compete against those dolphins. Anyway, there was a scene in Food, Inc. where an educator is in a school showing a classroom of kids what a honeydew is. This is what it looks like when it's whole. This is what it looks like when you cut it open. This is how it tastes. And again, this is called honeydew. Tell your parents that this is what you want to eat. Because the bigger food media gets and the wider the reach, even just something like a kid supermarket shopping with their mom and saying, hey, you know, instead of two bags of chips, can we get a honeydew and cut it up together? That's an enormous step. That's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to get into as many little untended corners as we can and try to encourage people to eat healthier, better food, which in turn will improve the food system. You have to vote with your wallet. You have to, you know, show people what you want in order for trends to catch on. So I think the more far-reaching food media gets and the more influence it has, the more positive changes will follow. I don't really see a huge downside other than sheer vanity of food media, but the big picture is very important, and I'm glad personally that we're headed in that direction.
So I think the takeaways here I'm hearing are, one, we can measure it by how well it supports your local economy for specialty items that are unique to those places that have a heritage. I think we can trace those back to nutritional choices that are being made regarding kind of the content and the quality of our food. And I think we can also measure it in the kind of environmental awareness that we have. So, I mean, I assume that many of you know that there's a drought in California and that almonds are a huge suck for water out there. And I suspect that maybe some of you have decided to forego your almonds or your avocados, or perhaps have seen them shoot up in price. And I think those are the kinds of conversations that we can assess how well our food media is working by how well consumer behavior changes. All right. Does anybody else have another question, comment? Oh, we got one in the corner, Sam.
Hi, I have a question. I kind of see food media in general as being catering a lot more to people who already have access to make really good choices about food and going for things that are authentic and have really good local ingredients. And all of you have mentioned a little bit about reaching more people who might not be able to afford to make all those choices the way food is structured in our country right now. Can you talk a little bit more about, like, in your ideal food media world, how you would reach out to those people?
After you.
I think that a lot of the stories that I gravitate towards and that I really try and tell when I'm pitching to outlets are stories about people doing things better than we're doing them right now. So I think there's a really exciting urban farming movement going on, definitely in New York City. It's really vibrant, but also across the country. New Orleans is doing a great job. Milwaukee is doing an amazing job. Detroit. A lot of places are carving out more space to grow food, but also to educate people. Like, I grew up in a city. I grew up in Montreal, and I'm embarrassed to say that I knew what a honeydew looked like, but I didn't know necessarily that, like, potatoes grew in the ground. It's pretty, you know, I work in food now, but it's true. You know, more and more people are living in cities. A lot of people are living in poor neighborhoods, food deserts, lacking access. And so I think telling stories to maybe the audience that does have access about what people are doing to try and get people access and get people thinking. And I've met so many incredible people on the ground in New York just getting really excited. There's a farmer in my neighborhood. I live in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, which is traditionally, you know, one of the oldest and largest African American communities in America. And they have a youth farm, and it's run completely by kids that grew up in the neighborhood. They run a farm stand on the weekends, and she's a huge voice, not just in Brooklyn, but in New York and nationally, talking about teaching kids to grow stuff. And so that's just one example, but I think, you know, highlighting people, pushing that conversation forward and pushing that access will get, you know, the people that already have access thinking about that a little more. And so that's my, you know, one of my goals as a reporter is to get more people talking about those solutions or innovations.
You're talking about Farmer Jan in Bed-Stuy?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing work. I think it is an immense privilege to do good in the food world. And I think if you have that privilege, you should use it. And I think we probably should be less shy about pushing things in the faces of people who are maybe not in a position, who could be in a position to make those changes. So I think the first step, and I don't have these answers right now, obviously, we're working on it, but I think the first step is to say, like, just like food, you can't eat gooey burgers all the time. You need to eat something that's good for you. And I think you need to eat something, you know, I think you need to ingest media that doesn't just feel good, that isn't just gasturbation, but is like actually good for you as someone who lives in a world where food is consumed every single day. And you need to take ownership over what you can do to alleviate the problems that are at your kind of your command to work on.
Absolutely. I think spreading food literacy, the basics of cooking, which are so important. I also edit the recipe section on Food Republic, and when I'm looking for a way to reach out to really anybody, it's it's not going to be like, so you have a slab of foie gras, what are you going to do now? It's more like 10 ways to use a can of black beans tonight, because all of these recipes cost under $7 to make and feed 4 people, and here's how you do it. Yep. Rather than, you know, go out to, you know, get takeout or order in, you know, something greasy that's not good for you. The food that you do have access to can be prepared really healthfully at home with your family, and that's a really important first step is cooking at home, being willing to cook at home with whole ingredients. So yeah. That's something that I like to really encourage every time I get the chance is to cook at home.
I want to give a big shout out actually to Leanne Brown, who just put out a cookbook called Good and Cheap, which is a PDF you can download. She funded through a Kickstarter campaign. And when you buy one online, she donates a physical copy to a family who is living on food assistance. And I think projects like that that really bridge that divide, that say the one-for-one model is not just for your Toms, it is for people in your own community who are struggling with food insecurity, and it's okay. And you guys can all cook the same thing, because cheap food and good food are often the same thing. You just need to take the initiative to make that first step and have access to the kind of information that will allow you to do that. All right, guys.
I just wanted to add that most farmers markets in New York, if not all, I actually wanted to ask you about that, do take food assistance. Mm-hmm. So you do see large communities just sort of, you know, buying these fresh greens and buying what's in season, learning what's in season, learning that, you know, in spring there's going to be radishes, and it's, you know, people tend to get excited about that. That's definitely an important...
There's a great program at New York City Farmers Markets. It's like double your bucks. So if you are using food stamps, you actually get double the purchasing power. So a dollar becomes two at the farmers market. So if any of you work in local government where you live, that's a great program to push, because it's really not that hard. It just requires a policy that will allow people to do that. And that, I think, is one of the smartest and most effective things that New York City's done.
So if anyone here is in local policy, your homework is to go home and do this in your community. And then let us know, and we'll make a radio piece about you. So I want to move on to our last section, which we have lovingly titled Food Rivalries, because what is a good food talk without a little bit of a food fight? So we're going to round this out with a shout out of a couple of food rivalries, and we'll let you guys cast your vote about which one you think is the winner of the SmackDown. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit to define what a food rivalry is, so we're all on the same page before we do that.
I think a food rivalry has a lot of local pride. It's sort of like a good sports team rivalry where, one, you don't know exactly why it started. Two, people get really heated about it. And three, it's comparing two things that are very similar but not totally the same. So there are these little points of difference that you can sort of debate and push for. I grew up in Montreal, like I said, and so one of my favorite food rivalries is the Montreal-New York City bagel rivalry. And those are, you know, they're both round pieces of bread that are often eaten with cream cheese, and you can buy them at, you know, a Depenner in Montreal or Bodega in New York, but they are prepared really differently, and people have been fighting about this forever. When I moved to New York, I was really staunch about it. So I think it's, you know, fun and lighthearted, but it also taps into sort of being proud of where you're from and engaging people, you know, in a competitive way about what you're used to, what you like, what traditions you see where you are.
A little hometown pride.
Yes.
Jess, do you agree?
I totally agree. It's about regional pride. We're proud of lots of things. In New York, we're proud of some strange things. But I'm sure that anybody else would love to debate us about it. But food is something that we all experience. Everybody, every single person eats. And most people feel passionately about some aspect of the food sphere. So I love that. The analogy to the sports teams, that's pretty much exactly what it's like. Also, if you've ever been close to a chef, you know that they're very intense people, very intense. And if they have something to go off on, that is exactly what they're going to do, sometimes just for our entertainment, which is great.
Okay, so we're going to throw a couple of these at you guys. By a show of hands, we'll do this. So the question is... Also, these are coming off a list from Anthony Bourdain, who, you know, if nothing else but be the contentious godfather of food media, I don't know what else to say about him.
Love starting fights.
Such a fight starter. I heard he used to throw knives at people, so we won't do that here. All right, guys. So Chicago or New York pizza? Can I get hands up for Chicago? It's a lot of hands, guys. Okay, let's do hands up for New York. I think I'm going to give this one to New York, guys. I think this little hometown pride is happening here. But props for Chicago pizza. I think we can get down with that, too. Okay, so we got barbecue. I know this is it's kind of a barbecue belt here. So North Carolina or Kansas City? North Carolina. Kansas City.
I'm checking out of this one.
We got a little tepid response here. Is there another kind of barbecue that we should be including in our barbecue snacks?
Let's get a Texan to tell us why.
Yeah,
where are all our Texans at?
Where are our Texans at? Throw your hands up. Let's talk to you about your barbecue.
You all just yelled.
No one wants to defend your barbecue, the great state of Texas.
I see a hand over by the phone.
All right, give this guy a mic. Nope, over here.
Right by the, yeah.
we just have the best damn barbecue there is, and that's really all there is to say about it.
So, are you guys convinced? Any defectors to Texas barbecue?
Sorry, Texas, it's not barbecue if it's not pork.
Ooh.
Memphis.
Dry rub. All right, let's get some hands up for Memphis. Make some noise for Memphis. Woo!
Texas.
All right, we got one last contender here for our barbecue roundup before we wrap up today. Let's hear it.
Saul's Barbecue, Birmingham, Alabama.
Birmingham. Yeah. All right, let's get some love for Birmingham. Okay, well, I think it's kind of close to tell what our barbecue preferences are, so I guess we'll leave that as to each his own.
It's a great American
debate. I think our preference is for barbecue.
Yeah, we're pro-barbecue here. All right, well, that's about all the time we have for today. I want to thank our panel, Jessica Padia from foodrepublic.com. She's their senior editor. We have Talia Ralph, who is a freelance journalist for a number of publications, including Vice and Lucky Peach. We are Heritage Radio Network. Again, this will be broadcast on our website, and we will put up the link on our social media. So you can find us at heritageradionetwork.org and a bunch of other programming on there as well. Thank you guys all for coming out. We are so thrilled to have you here. Enjoy the rest of Bonnaroo, you guys. You are the best. Woo. Keep eating, keep drinking, and keep talking about it.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.